Hello everyone, my name is Francis Donald and I'd like to welcome you to this session, the first in an ongoing series of webinars on sacred number and geometry. I'm really excited about hosting this series. This is something I've wanted to do for some time now. And it's really great to have you all here. It looks like we have 44 so far and counting, even though our staff swells the ranks a little bit. Thanks for signing up. So I'd like to introduce the staff. First of all, our technical white magician and wizard extraordinaire, Brett Mitchell. You want to say hi to everybody?
Hello.
And we have B.L. Allison, who has been very instrumental in setting up this particular webinar. Kudos to you, BL. I really appreciate it. Say hi.
Hello, everybody.
And with her, what's become a traditional hum, I think Michael figured out it was a B-flat, didn't he? And then we have, is Jo here, or is she not going to be here today? I don't know if she's here. Jo, no,
I don't
here.
See her yet.
No, I don't see her. Okay. All right, I'd like to start with a little bit of personal background. Two major shifts happened in my life back in the mid-80s. I began reading the ancient wisdom teachings with a lot more intensity, and as a result began painting esoteric subject matter. The piece on the screen right now, whoops, let's move it to the next piece here. This piece, is an example of my work, a more recent example of my work. The more I read, the more I was struck by what a causal role number and geometry play in the core teachings. Works like The Secret Doctrine and its latter-day counterpart, A Treatise on Cosmic Fire. Actually, it's the core of the core, because the where the esoteric quality of geometry and number really come forward in both books is in the stanzas of Zan. Some pronounce it Zion. For example, from the fourth stanza, which is on the screen now, in The Secret Doctrine, we have this astonishing passage, which reads, "From the effulgency of light, the ray of the ever darkness, sprung in space the reawakened energies, the one from the egg, the six, and the five. Then the three, the one, the four, the one, the five, the twice seven, the sum total. And these are the essences, the flames, the elements, the builders, the numbers, the arupa, the rupa, and the force of divine man, the sum total." Now, does everybody understand exactly what that means? Yeah, exactly. At first glance, these passages may seem totally impenetrable. But you might be surprised at what emerges with just a little bit of reflection. Obviously, it's way too early to dive into an analysis of this stanza now, but we will consider this very passage and others like it later in the series. Okay, let's talk a little bit about format. I would much rather that these webinars be an open conversation than a simple lecture series. So I encourage you to participate. But because we have so many attendees, we have to set a few ground rules. In the interest of our limited time together, please keep your questions and comments somewhat brief and always relevant to the point being discussed. I will from time to time introduce a key question to the group. In order to get through the material, we can only call on three people for each of these questions. I mean, you know, if we only had five attendees, we could just have an open conversation and it'd be much more relaxed around this particular point. But since we have a full house, we have to create some structure here. So if you raise your hand and don't get called on, it's only because we have a limited amount of time. Over the course of this webinar, we'll call on as many different people as we can. So that's a heads up to you, BL, too. I'll be bringing about an hour's worth of material to each webinar. This is an ongoing series, which means, you know, we could extend this conversation about sacred geometry literally at once a month for years. So, you know, at some point we may decide to cycle it and start over again, but at this point it's an ongoing series. Okay, so I'm going to bring about an hour's worth of material, and the additional half hour, because these webinars are scheduled to be an hour and a half long, will be for open discussion. All right, we're going to need to spend a few moments on some practical matters as quickly as we can get through this. The first thing is headsets. In order to verbally ask questions or make comments, I'm going to ask that you have a headset, because otherwise speaking sets up this strong disruptive echo. Well, you can get a headset. Let me hang on a sec. Get my ducks in a row here. Here we go. Yeah, you can get a headset on Amazon.com starting at around $7. $14 will get you a decent one. 20-something will get you a really nice one. Do not spend what they suggest here, $100 on a headset. It's just not necessary. There's lots of online computer outlets where you can get these. Just type headset in the search field and you're good to go. But if you plan on attending future webinars, you definitely want to get a headset of some kind. Okay, once you plug your headset in, you'll want to follow these instructions. Thanks to BL who created this slide. This is for a PC. You'll see in your control panel, partway down, you'll see this audio block. If it has a plus sign, just click on it and you'll see a mic and speakers option. Click on that once your headset is plugged in and you're good to go. If you have a Mac, as soon as you plug your headset in, you'll get a dialog box that says your computer detects some new hardware. Would you like to use it? Click OK, and you're set up. Okay. There's basically two buttons that you're going to need to be aware of. One of them is this one right here. It's at the top left, this row of icons on your control panel, and it's the self-mute button. If you click this, you'll have an option to mute or unmute. The staff will keep you muted until you raise your hand. And that is the hand raise button, which is right here. You'll see a little hand with an arrow pointing up. Now, some of the most profound minds in the Moria Federation are still confused by this button, because it shows what will happen if you push the button rather than the current state, right? So once you push this button, your hand will be raised. Then it will show a hand with an arrow pointing down. Once you push the button, your hand will be lowered. Okay. All right. Down in, partway down your control panel, you'll see this box right here where it says type message here. Okay. This is a second way to communicate with the staff. You'll find a text box there that you can copy paste and put in quotes there. If for some reason you're having trouble with your sound, you can type in a request there. This is a sure way of getting through to us. Also, today, if you don't have a headset, please use this box for your questions and comments. The other panels, like the list of attendees, are self-explanatory, and none of them are necessary for your participation. So not to worry. Alrighty, let's talk for a moment about what we'll be covering in this series. During the next mini webinars, we'll be exploring the philosophic implications of each of the first 10 numbers through their related geometry, through mythology, through the teachings passed down to us from ancient civilizations, and through the ancient wisdom teachings themselves. Of course, there's no way to completely isolate one particular number from another. You know, for instance, here you have two circles, and so it's definitely representative of the number two, right? But this central space makes it resonant with the number three as well. And in fact, in this space, all the numbers that follow come out of the space, the numbers 3 through 12 most significantly. My point being just simply that it will never be a completely isolated working with each number specifically. We'll be crossing into the other numbers as we go. Okay, the Moria Federation, which hosts this series, and of which I am a faculty member, as are Brett and BL, many people on board today, is strongly based in the works of Alice Bailey. Here's Alice on the left. And she worked with a master whose name is Dual Cool. And together they wrote this amazing compendium of esoteric thought, 24 books. She also wrote some on her own. So you'll have to forgive us if I often reference these books. If you're not familiar with them, possibly you'll develop a taste for these works and explore them on your own through the Moria Federation. Reminds me, I want to put a plug in for this amazing organization. If you like this webinar series, go to moriafederation.org and if you search around, you'll find a donate button, right? None of the staff get paid. If willing to drop some money in the jar that you'll find there, basically you'll be able to keep these websites up and running, or help keep them up and running. So, any help you can do there would be much appreciated. Okay, so you'll hear me often saying the Tibetan says, or Dual Cool says, or DK says, and this is referencing this master who worked with Alice Bailey. Okay, that's enough of an introduction. Let's get started. It's easy to think of sacred geometry as a kind of niche subject, a little cubbyhole in the ancient wisdom teachings, right? But actually, sacred geometry and numbers stand in a causal relationship to all the other esoteric disciplines. If we were able to experience the healing arts or esoteric psychology or astrology on archetypal levels, we would find that the essence of these disciplines expresses itself through a life force specifically conditioned by number and geometry, right? All of manifestation is formed by and infused with number expressing itself as order in space. The Deva and the elemental kingdoms, which make manifestation possible, could be described as number and geometry infused with consciousness, a consciousness directed by the will of God, which for the Deva kingdom is the path of least resistance. Of course, modern science doesn't recognize the manifested world as having a sacred source, but they do recognize the determining role that number and geometry play. In fact, as time goes on, this becomes more and more clear. So why doesn't science consider number and geometry sacred? Simply because it doesn't recognize planes of substance higher than the physical, physical gaseous, that is, nor does it recognize states of consciousness other than the physical, emotional, and lower mental. Thus, it is inherently unable to consider its own amazing array of subject matter in terms of the sacred. Now, this is going to change. The Tibetan tells us that as people achieve etheric vision, silence will change with that. But for the time being, in spite of the fact that science, for the most part, has embraced Einstein's revelation that matter is energy, the time is not yet. Okay, let's take a look at the pervasive impact that number and geometry have in the manifested world. This statement is from the introduction of one of the best books on the subject, entitled simply Sacred Geometry by Robert Lawler. If you're serious about this subject, this book should definitely be on your short list of must reads. It's just a phenomenal book. Would somebody like to read this paragraph? Come on, you need a volunteer. Somebody jump in just to read? Don't be shy. There's only 57 people.
We have several hands up now.
Oh, great. Choose one and have them read.
Okay. Arrest, would you like to read it? Let me unmute you. There, you're unmuted, Arrest.
Function in response to the geometrical or proportional, not quantitative, differences inherent in the stimuli they receive. For example, when we smell a rose, we are not responding to the chemical substances of its perfume, but instead to the geometry of their molecular construction. That is to say, any chemical substance that is bonded together in the same geometry as that of the rose will smell as sweet. Robert Lawler.
Yeah, that's an astonishing concept, isn't it? That it's that what we smell is determined by the geometry rather than by the actual substance. You could say we're smelling geometry, and this applies to all our senses. Orest, do you have any thoughts about this paragraph?
The master smells of the rose.
Yes, indeed. Thank you. Thank you for that. Okay, now let's take a look at the first key question for today's webinar. What makes a number or a geometrical shape sacred? You know, you pull out a piece of paper and draw a circle on it. Is that circle sacred? What's the difference between third grade arithmetic or high school math and sacred number in geometry? Any thoughts on this? BL? What makes anything sacred? Why is holy water considered to be holy? Anybody have any ideas on this? Don't be shy. Just jump in. Just whatever occurs to you, because it's going to be occurring to a lot of other people too.
Still
no hands,
BL?
Oh my goodness.
Takers.
Okay, let's look at some quotes.
Oh, hold on. I've got a taker.
Yes.
Malia, go ahead.
I'm being very brave, and I'm guessing that what happens is that there is a subjective recognition that somehow it creates more space and more possibility and more awareness.
That's a terrific answer, and you also get three extra points for being the first ever to jump in. Thank you. Malia, is that right?
Yes.
Yes. I think you put your finger on it when you said that it's a recognition of the subjective, right? because it's, you know, any form that we're looking at, you know, for instance, this, you take out a piece of paper and you draw a circle on it, is not elevated to, well, let me say it another way. It's a potential for invoking the subjective. So if it's used in such a way as, for instance, in temple construction, it can become sacred through an infusion by the subjective essence, right? Okay, let's look at a quote that might get us into the frame of mind where an answer to this question become a little clearer. Algis Uzdavinis. Now, wouldn't you love to have a name like that? Uzdavinis, a Lithuanian philosopher who did comparative studies of Greek and Egyptian thought, says, geometry, working with the aid of the imagination, is able to bring about recollection of the eternal ideas of the soul. It's a simple statement, but it's jam-packed with ideas. What does this quote suggest to you? Keep in mind that Uzdavinis was a Neoplatonist, or held the beliefs of the Neoplatonists, and they believed, they elevated imagination to a very high level. They felt that it was led to intuition and is thus key to visualizing sacred geometry. So here's the quote again. Geometry working with the aid of the imagination is able to bring about recollection of the eternal ideas of the soul. There's a lot in this statement. Anybody want to be as brave as Malia was and step up to the plate to give some thoughts about this? Biel?
Eva had her hand up to respond when Malia did, but let's give her a chance. Let's give her a chance.
Absolutely.
Go ahead, Eva. Eva, are you there?
Hi, Eva. You have the option of responding to the original question, or if you'd like to respond to this one, either. By the way, it's great to have you here. Thanks for signing up. Are you on self-mute on your headset? I often do this, so let's give her a second. Okay. Well, anyone else? Come on, brave souls. This something must occur to you in connection with this statement. Okay, for me, one of the most interesting parts of this quote is the suggestion that it's a remembered idea, right? That this eternal idea is remembered, but remembered from when? From some previous high meditation? Or was it while reunited with the soul when out of incarnation? It's a provocative suggestion, this idea that the eternal ideas is remembered. Has anybody stepped up to the plate here? Any thoughts? Okay, let's move on for now.
Yeah,
we have
yes.
Sheldon. Yeah.
Terrific, Sheldon.
Well, just along the lines as a remembered idea, there may be the hint here that in the imagination, that part of the mind, there is, that we're born with, in a sense, there is a store of truth and these ideas, at least in terms of shapes and numbers,
yes.
Maybe not the actual words themselves, are there for us to recollect.
Yes. Yeah, we're in a sense accessing our own Akashic reality in that sense. Yeah, good point. Thank you. Okay, we have another premise in Uzdavinis's quote.
We had another comment from
Luca.
Luca, go ahead.
Hello.
Hi, Luca.
Can you hear me? Yes.
Yes, we can.
This kind of reminds me of an evocative nature of geometry. That a form can evoke something subjective, something that is present but not manifested yet. And the imagination works as a bridging faculty between this form, evocative form of geometry and the inner, let's say, archetype or something, idea.
Yes, thank you. They form a kind of bridge, allowing us to move from the manifest to the unmanifest. Thank you for that. That's great. One of the points that Usdavinas makes here is that he actually links this process of becoming, our journey on the spiritual path, to contemplation of sacred geometry, as Luca just suggested, right? Thus recognizing it or proclaiming it as a valid spiritual discipline. In other words, this isn't just a lot of cool figures that have amazing coincidences and attributes, but that it's also a form of esoteric psychology, isn't it? Because through the study or contemplation, we can actually move forward on the spiritual path. Right? Usdavinas certainly wasn't the first to propose this idea. The Greeks, and most notably the Pythagoreans, used the contemplation of number and archetypal forms as their primary method for reconnecting to the spiritual realms. In fact, so much so that above the portal of Plato's Academy were written the words, "Let no one ignorant of geometry enter," right? That wouldn't really work on our schools, would it? Have a lot of people out in the parking lot. Okay, let's take one last look at Usdavinas' quote. What do you think he means by the eternal ideas of the soul? Any thoughts on this? But before you answer, let's take a look at what the Tibetan has to say about eternal ideas, this whole concept of the eternal idea. This is from the book Glamour, A World Problem. Could we get a volunteer? Now you're all warmed up. This should be like rolling off a log.
Tina has her hand up. Go ahead, perfect. Tina, I've unmuted you.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, the soul throws its light upward and outward, and the idea, nebulous and faint, emerges into the consciousness of the man. It stands revealed much as an object stands revealed when the bright beam of a powerful searchlight is thrown upon it. The mind, endeavoring to remain in constant, steady conscious contact with the soul, seeing into the higher world through the medium of the soul's wide opened eye, registers the idea with increasing clarity.
Thank you. Thank you, Tina. I appreciate that. You see how Dwell Cool has elevated the concept of an idea far beyond the way we use it in daily speech. You know, we're definitely not talking about, hey, I have a good idea. Let's go get an ice cream, right? I mean, one way of evaluating the importance of an idea is to note how long it remains relevant. The more elevated the idea, the longer it stays active. So ideas like God is love come pretty clearly from the highest levels and thus qualify as Usdavinas' eternal ideas of the soul. And that's the level of ideation that number and geometry exist on in their most archetypal state. And it's on these levels that we'll be focusing our study. It's also important to understand that as an idea descends into brain consciousness, it becomes distorted and loses most of its potency, a potency that can only be regained through meditation on the realm where the ideas are generated. Easier said than done, but you know, the attempt needs to be made. And that can be accessed, at least according to Uzdavinus and the ancient Greeks, through contemplation of sacred geometry. Here's one of my pieces entitled Genesis of an Idea, which was inspired by the quote from the Tibetan that we just read and other similar quotes from him. This artwork shows four planes of consciousness. Up here you have the Buddhic plane. This is the higher and lower mental, the astral and the physical plane. And on the level of the Buddhic plane, you have this just a bit of this great disc, which represents an idea, a true idea that is completely separated or other than the idea as it is perceived by any human, and this ovoid represents the receptive consciousness of probably a fairly high initiate. I would imagine like a third degree initiate, mainly because of the clarity of the ovoid and of the regularness of its shape. And you notice that that he or her has the Buddha plane at its head consciousness and is therefore able to receive the reflection of this eternal idea. But right away you see the difference between, you know, even in this metaphoric illustration, the difference between this great, you know, blazing disc that shines forth on the Buddhic and this dim reflection. And then that makes its way down into the, you know, through the higher mental, down into the lower mental plane, and becomes the codified brain conscious idea of, you know, an individual unit of consciousness, right? And you notice the tremendous difference between this and this. It's greatly reduced, yet nonetheless, if this unit of consciousness is a Leonardo da Vinci or a Michelangelo or even a Woodrow Wilson, this idea can change the course of civilization, can't it? And then it makes its own way from the level of idea to the level of the ideal as it moves into the astral plane. And you can see it makes its ripples and drops onto the physical plane manifestation, where it actually works out on the physical plane. For instance, in the case of Woodrow Wilson, as the League of Nations, right? So maybe this is a little bit pessimistic. Maybe this should be, you know, a little bit brighter down here. But so you have this chart which can represent the genesis of an idea from an idea unfettered all the way down to its physical manifestation through the consciousness of a receptive unit of consciousness. Okay, let's look at another quote, this one from Socrates. He said simply, geometry is the art of the ever-true. Do you see the similarity between the ever-true and the eternal idea? Right? If we get back to, they both exist up in this place, don't they? Now let's stretch a little. Keith Critchlow, who many consider to be the dean of modern sacred geometry, tells us, when matter emerged, principle was already there. Otherwise, no order could have ensued. In other words, manifestation works from the top down, right? From this level, which is the archetypal, down into the physical plane levels. The archetype always comes first, followed by the specific. So we have Critchlow's pre-existing principle, Uzdavinus's eternal idea, and Socrates' art of the ever-true, all describing pretty much the same reality. All numbers and geometrical forms are, on archetypal levels, eternal ideas, which have a profound impact on our world. What other words could we use to describe this archetypal realm? What words actually describe this? I'll get us going with this. Formless, invariable, relatively invariable, relatively timeless, having quality in addition to quantity, right? Potent with spirit. So let's hear some one-liners, and this is, we're not limiting to three here, just if you have an idea of an adjective that would describe the archetypal realm, put it forth, BL.
Okay, Eva has her hand up.
Great.
But it keeps moving from one Eva to another. So let me see if I can catch her. Eva?
Hi.
Yay!
I'm sorry, I got my computer froze as soon as I heard my name a lot earlier. So I had to re-register and start all over. So I don't know if what I'm going to say has already been said by someone else or discussed.
It's all right.
But I'm going back to your original question, which was,
that's fine.
What is sacred geometry? And actually, what I will say, it fits into all these different quotes that we've been reading. And all I can contribute to that is that it's the ability to reflect deity. It's the ability to reflect deity in number. So we know, for example, through our studies that deity is the triplicity. So, you know, even the number three then is somehow reflected in the geometry. But it is through soul, which eventually will lead us to penetrate, for those that have the ability to penetrate even higher, that one will receive that which is the true, the good, and the beautiful, and that will reflect deity on some level. So
yes,
that comes out then eventually in our geometrical patterns.
Yeah, terrific. Thanks so much for that. That's great. It suggests that, you know, there is some extraordinarily high consciousness whose essence is threeness itself, right? And that is blended into deity as it manifests in triplicity. Yes, thank you for that. Okay. Let's see. Here's Keith, by the way. What do I have here? Oh, yeah. The Tibetan tells us that pure reason will ever express itself in right action. And, wait a minute, I skipped a little bit. Let me go back up. Sorry about that, guys.
Can I tell you that we got a couple of one-word comments?
Please, no, I didn't mean to jump on that at all. For some reason, I'm not really seeing your hand, so...
I had to move over to the other. I'm sorry. That's
all right. Sorry. That's fine.
Malia contributed purity, and Martin contributed boundless.
Ooh, yeah. It's right on in both cases. Yeah.
And Joe says synthetic.
Mm, right. Especially with Buddhic levels. Boundless, in part because at these levels, you're moving beyond space as we normally think of it. So it has the quality of boundlessness, right? Thanks. Thank you all for contributing on that. Okay. The Greeks called the archetypal realm, which we were just looking at. Let me get back there. Here we go. So this realm here. They called it pure reason. esoteric Hinduism called this state of consciousness heart-mind, which is similar to the ancient Egyptian name for it, which was intelligence of the heart. That's my personal favorite. The Tibetan tells us, now I can go to this line, pure reason will ever express itself in right action and right human relations. And that will manifest, when present, what love in reality is. Pure love is a quality or effect of pure reason. So you see how he's tying together in this modern theosophical thought this concept of the Greeks as pure reason and both the Hindu and the Egyptian ideas of the intelligence of the heart and heart mind, right? I mean, we don't immediately, when we hear the term reason, this is one of those limitations of English again, that we certainly don't immediately jump to the idea that it's quality of the heart. But as someone suggested that, purity is an attribute of the archetypal, so pure reason is an entirely different expression than the reason that we normally equate, the ability to equivocate, and to compare that we have through the lower mind. It's altogether other than that. Okay, sacred number in geometry is also a quality or demonstrated effect of pure reason. In fact, I go so far as to say that hidden from all but the highest initiates, at least I would imagine so, there is a life essence that expresses itself through a geometric form that, through its line of proportion, embodies the energy of love wisdom. Now, I can imagine such a figure adorning the hidden portal that leads up into the Buddhic plane. This whole concept of levels of awareness has played a part in every spiritual philosophy and in every culture. The Greeks gave us the archetypal and the typal, as shown in this diagram, called the Socratic divided line. Here you'll see three important elements. The pole of unity up here, and its polar opposite, the pole of multiplicity, and then the mean division, which, by the way, is divided along the lines of the golden mean. And then notice that the mathematics and geometry are just across the line in this whole archetypal realm. The Egyptians added a third level called the ectypal. And that level lies between the two. For instance, if you had, if this level would represent, for instance, a hammer, an actual physical hammer, then this level would represent all implements capable of creating blunt force, right? But it's not itself on a physical plane. It's the idea of this. But this level represents the deification of the whole concept of applied force. So that's the Egyptian triplicity of this. And then we have, for many of you, what is very familiar, which is the seven levels of being, consciousness, and awareness of the theosophical movement. This is from, it appears in many books, but it's in A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, for instance. And you have the physical plane, the emotional plane, mental plane, intuitional, spiritual, monadic, and divine, or adi, planes of existence. So for the time being, we're going to stick with this level, this way of dividing just the archetypal and the typal when we deal with sacred geometry, just for the time being. Thomas Taylor was an amazing individual who lived at the turn of the 18th and 19th centuries. He was a translator of ancient Greek philosophy and really one of the great esotericists of that time. His works are truly inspired. Could we get somebody to read this this paragraph from Thomas Taylor? He describes this, or gives us some insight into this duality of typal and archetypal. Volunteers?
Okay, before we get to that, you have a question.
Okay.
What do you mean by the golden mean?
Okay. Well, you know, shortly we're going to get to that, so if you'll just have a bit of patience, I'll answer your question soon.
Okay, and then I don't see any volunteers yet to...
Okay, we need a reader. Somebody jump in.
Sam.
Great.
Go ahead, Sam.
All right. All mathematical forms have a primary subsistence in the soul, so that prior to the sensible, she contains self-motive numbers, vital figures prior to such as are apparent, harmonic ratios prior to things harmonize, and invisible circles prior to the bodies that are moved in a circle.
Great. Thanks, Sam. In other words, the formless world of number, geometry, and harmony precedes and determines the existence of its physical plane creations, right? This is central to the whole concept of sacred number and geometry, because if we don't allow for the possibility of an archetypal reality, we're left only with the form side. Actually, we're left with nothing at all, since form cannot manifest from nothing. The archetypal realm is where we'll find all of the sacred guiding principles having to do with number and geometry. These principles are diverse and yet at the same time deeply interrelated. The higher we shift our perspective, the more interrelated they become, until on the highest planes of the archetypal plane, these principles merge into one great expression. Though these principles are invisible to most of us, even a cursory look at the world around us reveals their effect or impress. In fact, certain guiding principles dominate nature. For example, here we have one of our most important guiding principles. Hang on a sec. Which charts the Fibonacci sequence. And here, one of its objectifications, in this case, a shell shown cut in half, that manifests precisely in accordance with the Fibonacci sequence. The same Fibonacci sequence determines the growth pattern of the horn on a big horn sheep, like this one. It only encompasses part of the sequence, but it is ruled by that sequence. Here we have a guiding principle and its manifestation shown together. The center part of this is, again, the Fibonacci sequence, shown with these pollen buds. As they progress outwards, they do so in accordance with this sequence, right? And this also is formed in part by the pentad as a guiding principle. And finally, we have the guiding principle, and now I'm going to answer your question about the golden mean. This time, the golden mean, that is subjectification as the proportions of a human being. Now, we don't have time to take a really close look at this, but this is going to be the subject matter of an entire webinar, this one guiding principle called the golden mean. But briefly, the idea of the golden mean is simply that this larger segment, when added to this segment, is in relationship to the larger segment. In other words, this whole A plus B, is in relation to this larger segment as this segment is to this, right? So the entire segment is in relationship to the larger segment as the larger is to the smaller. This has profound ramifications. Let's look at this here, for instance. One of the most obvious, you see how here we have the pink is the small segment and the blue is the large. That holds on this chart. So you have, for instance, the area between the navel and the top of the head is in a golden mean proportion, which, by the way, is 1 to 1.618. There will be a test later. It's in a golden mean proportion to the section from the navel to the bottom of the feet. And you can see many other relationships here. And this is only a fraction of the relation of the golden mean relationship of the human body. The joints of the fingers, the face is divided in this way. And we'll get into, like I said, we'll get into this in some depth in a future webinar. Okay, and finally, we have a guiding principle that manifests as the fivefold tracery of the planet Venus's movement through the heavens as seen from Earth. So if you were to take a time exposure of the planet Venus, this is what the pattern would look like. Clearly, it's fivefold, isn't it? And, well, you know, for you esotericists, we know that that the fifth ray is one of the rays that comes to us from Venus. And certainly, this fifth ray is part of the guiding principle of this external tracery, right? And this is an example of a guiding principle that manifests on macrocosmic levels, right? Not just through nature on our planet. In fact, if we look at the microcosm, we discover that these guiding principles govern matter on a cellular level, as revealed by this diffraction pattern of Rubisco, which is the most abundant protein in nature. And by this cross-section and helix pattern of a DNA cell, science now knows that it's this helix pattern of the DNA cell that is responsible for DNA's replicating power. Again, just like the rose, it's not the molecules of substance, right? But rather the specific geometry of the helix, here you see it on the right here, that gives DNA its replicating power. Since DNA is a key factor in determining how our bodies manifest and grow, it's not too great a stretch to say that geometry determines and governs our bodily existence. I mean, this is really astonishing. This is a cross-section of a DNA cell, and this is Keith Crichlow's work again. He finds this really precise pentad relationship. And whenever we're talking about fiveness or the pentad, we are talking about the Fibonacci sequence and the golden mean, which is the power of generation. So it's, if there was going to be a number that controlled this form, this DNA cell, it makes perfect sense that it's the power of fiveness and the pentad. Like I said, we will be getting into this in some depth. Okay. Keith Crichlow. These are other books that you might want to have on your short list. However, this book is not an easy read, but it's a fabulous reference book and source book. Anyway, he wrote this book in 1962 and with it reinvigorated the modern movement in sacred geometry. And he tells us in this book, which was written 50 years later, Hidden Geometry of Flowers, that the way photosynthesis converts light into food remains a complete mystery to science. They do know that the chemical components of chlorophyll cannot turn light into food unless arranged in this specific mandala-like pattern, which significantly is almost identical to a molecule of hemoglobin. In both cases, it's a geometric pattern that allows life to manifest. So you could take all of these atomic substances and notice how similar they are, right? Carbon, nitrogen, in both cases, and then magnesium lies at the center here and iron here. You could take these and combine them in any other way and you would not gain a molecule of substance that could turn light into food, which itself is a mind-blowing concept, right? But what strikes me is that in both cases, it's a geometric form that allows life to manifest. When iron lies at the center of the mandala, it manifests as animals and human beings. When magnesium stands at the center, life manifests as the plant kingdom. Interesting, isn't it, that the two fundamental realms that science recognizes as life forms both require the same mandala-like pattern, right? So here's like an inside tip on how sacred geometers work. You reverse engineer. Here we have the pointed cross, right, sitting on top of this eightfold pattern, or you can also see it as a 12-sided pattern. So this gives you insight into these geometrical figures. There's the quality of the nature of the cross is indicated by the fact that these pointed cross mandalas, when arranged in such a way and with these chemical substances, are the source of life. Okay, I think we've at least begun to answer our first question, which is what makes sacred geometry sacred. You know, a more accurate name for geometry, which just means measuring the earth, would be order in space, since number and geometry are inherently related to space. I mean, that's shown here. It's the spatial relationship that allows substance to affect nature in the way it does. You change the spatial arrangement and it completely changes the way substance manifests. So let's take a quick look at the whole concept of space. Who would like to read this quote from Lao Tzu?
First, I have a couple of comments.
Okay.
Malia, back when you were talking about, you know, the purity and the pure reason and love, she said that was exemplified by Venus, and then your other slides followed in on that when you showed exactly how Venus and the fifth ray work in that pure reason. So that was a great comment that she added that you piggybacked off of. And then, interestingly...
Hang on. Let's address that and then we'll go to the next, okay?
Okay.
Okay. That's a terrific observation. You know, we could follow up by saying, too, that Venus, you know, is the is in relation to the earth as the soul is in relation to the personality, right? And this soul level is on the higher mental and Buddhic plane. So you have yet another indication of this connection. Yeah, okay.
All right, and then Michael Stacy, can you go back to the previous slide for a second?
Sure.
Michael Stacy added that lobsters have copper in the center of the mandala there. So isn't that interesting?
Yeah, it is. Is it? Do you know if it's the same mandala? I wonder.
Here, let me. Michael, go ahead.
My wife, Dr. Laurel Stacy, gave me that information. I do not know if it's the same. She seemed to think that it is very much identical to that which is shown on the slide.
You know what would be a fascinating study for a sacred geometer would be to look at as many life forms as possible and see what the conditioning central element is, and then to look at the atomic makeup of these. Like for instance, magnesium here, if we were to look at the atomic number of magnesium, it would inherently give us insight into the nature of the plant kingdoms. Of course, the same thing would be true for iron. And copper and lobsters, huh? That's fascinating. Thanks for that. Okay, do we have any other input here?
Yes, we have a couple of more hands. I'm not sure if they have. Let me start with, I'm probably going to butcher the name. Is it Dacia? Dacia?
It's Dacia.
Dacia.
Dacia. I was just offering to read the quote.
Oh, great.
Are you ready for that now?
Well, let's see if there's anybody else that...
Well, the other hand went down, so I guess that was the same thing.
Okay, let's go on then. All right, so let me back up just a sec and say that this is by way of an introduction to the whole concept of exploring space as one of the intrinsic elements of sacred geometry. Okay, so go ahead. This is a quote by Lao Tzu.
30 spokes converge upon a single hub. It is on the hole in the middle that the use of the cart hinges. We make a vessel from a lump of clay. It is the empty space within the vessel that makes it useful. We make doors and windows for a room, but it is the empty spaces that make the room livable. Thus, while the tangible has advantages, it is the intangible that makes it useful.
Thanks very much. Useful as well as relevant and potent.
Mm-hmm.
One geometric figure well suited for representing space is the cube, which when it's used in this way is called the cube of space. Here, I got an illustration of it here. Right. Viewed in this way, we're not referring to the cube as we usually understand it. Rather, it's a borderless form that allows us to combine the four directions with the above and the below, right? These six directions are represented by this cube's six faces, but those six faces don't limit these directions. The cube of space is thus a metaphor for describing physical space. Now, the Tibetan tells us that the number six, which is the number of direction in space and the number of the faces of a cube, is the number of form or of manifestation, which is the agent or medium through which the consciousness is unfolded so that it can become the foundation of the higher process. Does everybody understand that? If you know, for those of you familiar with the septenary chart of the cosmic physical, and don't worry about it if you don't know what that is, but I know many of you do. You know, we have the six subplanes, and at each level, you know, the physical, emotional, mental, buddhic, etc. The six subplanes represent the manifestation of the seventh or first, if you're counting from above downwards, called the Udi plane, right? So here's another way of using sacred geometry, right? If we look at this point as the Adi plane, or the logoic plane of consciousness, which is unmanifest, and that it manifests in six directions, and those represent the six subplanes, right? I mean, you could have a lot of fun deciding, you know, which of the subplanes these six faces of the cube represent. But just to see the relationship, you know, DK is telling us here that six is the number of form or of manifestation, right? You know, we live inside a cube of space. In fact, we could call the entire cosmic physical plane a cube of space. Thus, we could hypothesize that those energies that determine the cube, right, that infuse the cube and make it look as it looks, and the principle that determines the field in which manifestation takes place, have a lot in common, right? In fact, they may be one and the same. Said another way, we might surmise that one of the esoteric qualities of the cube is that it is a natural field for manifestation to occur. And thus, the space within and around a cube is inherently receptive to this manifesting energy. So when you're considering a cube, or you see a cube, or you're contemplating a cube, remember this particular quality. It's verified for us by the Tibetan that it represents the forces of manifestation. But just like the cube, the space within and around any three-dimensional figure is charged with some specific conditioning energy, isn't it? And thus the figure becomes, you know, as we see it physically, the figure becomes like an outpost or an active beacon for that source energy, just like the cube is an active beacon for the source of manifestation. And for the sacred geometry, this gives us clues as to the nature of the source. So if you want to know the sense of the source of the dodecahedron, then you study this figure, right? But it is, we have to always remember that it's the conditioning energy that determines what the figure truly is. The attributes of the form, how many lines, how many vertices, how many faces, and just the overall look and feel, they proclaim and reinforce the source energy's existence, but never forget that they are not themselves the source of these figures. When we construct three-dimensional figures, we naturally invoke the higher energies to inhabit them. But when we then contemplate these figures, we connect with their living source. Or that's the hope. You know, that's the path, right, described for us by Uzda Venus earlier on. When this happens, these figures become a conduit for the sacred. This charge or presence also exists in combinations of sacred figures, such as a temple, and even in very complex combinations like us, which, after all, is the only true temple, because even though certain forms have the potential to be conduits for their source, this linking only happens through alignment with our own sacred source. The Tibetan tells us that once we begin aligning with that source, as Chagall shows us here, the geometry that represents our consciousness becomes less distorted. He actually makes this, he equates consciousness with geometry. And that geometry that is, in a sense, our geometric signature gradually becomes simpler and more refined. In other words, more in keeping with the archetypal model, right? I actually own this piece and I absolutely love it, because here you have this guiding principle. You know, it could be your soul, it could be a high geometric form, it could be whatever you're able to tap into, you know, showing the way to the Golden City, which in, you know, Marc Chagall's tradition was, his being Jewish, was Jerusalem, right? And then you have, you know, the blinded personality, which at least knows enough to reach up and, you know, make the effort, right? Okay. Let's see. What does all this have to do with space? We have a man named L.A. Govinda tells us that the infinity of space and the infinity of consciousness are identical. That's a profound thought. The way in which we experience space or in which we are aware of space is a characteristic of the dimension of our consciousness, right? In other words, the infinity of space and the infinity of consciousness are identical. This becomes easier to understand when we remember the Tibetans' teachings on the subject. He tells us that space is an entity. In fact, let's have somebody read this.
Francis?
Yeah.
Do you have time for a quick question or comment from Lynn?
Absolutely.
Before we do that? Okay,
absolutely.
Lynn, I've unmuted you if you'd like to ask your question about the chlorophyll.
I was wondering where you got the 12 from the diagram.
Unless I miscounted, it was just counting the points around it. Let me go back here. Let's see, 1, 2, 3. Wait a minute, faces, I think is what I was saying.
Oh, okay.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. No, I didn't get it from that. God knows where I got it. sorry
well,
about that. Yeah.
It would be great if it were 12, because they're talking about base 12 as being emblematic of life, you know, seeing
that's
the life
it.
Force and things.
Yeah, I
was
don't
trying
know where
to
I got
figure
that.
Out. You know, sorry.
Let me see. Wait a minute. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Well, there you have it.
It's the 8 lines that you've got on the inside, and then the four ends, and then the 8 lines between them. I don't know how to describe it.
Okay.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Okay. Anyway, homework. Find 12 of these figures.
Okay. Thank you.
But thanks. Yeah, thanks for that. Okay. Could we have a reader?
I don't see any hands up
okay.
yet.
Okay. I'll read it. That's fine.
I got one here.
Okay. Great.
Scott, go ahead.
Okay. Space is an entity, and the entire vault of heaven is the phenomenal appearance of that entity. This entity is one and the same as the cosmic Christ, referred to by St. Paul as the body of Christ. The glory of man lies in the fact that he is aware of space and can imagine this space as the field of divine living activity.
Thank you. It's a profound statement. You know, it's the kind of statement that could start a revolution, really, if enough people took it to heart. Yeah, and it gives us a lot of insight into ideas like God is as close as our breath, doesn't it? But we're not just talking about outer space when we refer to a field of divine living activity. Oh, by the way, I have to tell you, I spent about 2 hours constructing a little episode here where I played the theme to Star Trek, but then it turned out that you can't hear music on that I play, so we had to throw that out. You just have to take my word for it that it was an awesome segment. Okay. So we're not just talking about outer space when we refer to a field of divine living activity. Every temple ever built was designed in such a way that it would charge the space it encompasses. The most esoteric of these spaces, such as the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid and the so-called sarcophagus that lies within it, you can see that down here, used specific geometrical proportions to create an environment to condition the space in such a way that, at least I believe, initiatory rites could take place. How is this possible? How is it that specific geometric proportions are even capable of conditioning space in such a way that certain specific results can manifest? Any thoughts about this? This is a tough question. We've come back to a more in-depth version of our original question, which was, what makes sacred geometry sacred? But here we're saying, how is it that specific geometric proportions are even capable of conditioning a space in some particular way that allows us to achieve certain results? Do we have any brave souls or great thinkers? I'll take either.
We do have a comment from Guadalupe.
Great.
Go ahead. Lupita, are you there? I've got you unmuted. You may need to self-mute yourself.
Yeah, your headset may have a mute button that's turn to mute.
Did you hear me now?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. My idea is that you ask why. Is it possible that each number has or carries a particular vibration, and the combination of the different vibrations of the numbers, which form the geometric figure, gives the energy for those initiatory purposes.
Fantastic. Thank you. Yes, I agree with you. The hypothesis that I came up with is that I think that at least part of the answer lies in the fact that number, as it manifests through a space built using unique geometrical proportions, sets up a vibratory field, and that field radiates the qualities and potencies of the numbers involved, right? Which is very much what you were just saying. Each vibratory rate has a particular potency and determined by the proportions used. It's that potency, when brought into manifestation through a unique vibratory field, that facilitates certain esoteric activities. I mean, we're talking about a very high level of white magic here. I suspect, in fact, that those great temple architects of old who had, as Plato said, polished the eye of the soul, in other words, whose ajna centers were open, I suspect that they could design sacred spaces not based on a textbook, but based on a direct awareness of the effect of the potency of the number and proportions that they were using, right? This direct awareness was not just that the space would be charged, but that that charge or presence would be of a specific quality in order to facilitate a particular purpose. Does everyone get the gist of what I'm talking about here? It's like designing vibratory fields to gain certain or specific results. An awesome concept, but one that I think is present in rooms like this one. Now, what's fascinating about the ancient Egyptians was that their gods were considered to be embodiments of certain divine principles, as I mentioned before, right? And a divine principle and a vibratory field are in some ways one and the same thing. So creating spaces that resonated with the vibratory field of the particular god or potency that they were wishing to attract, of course, greatly enhanced their power to invoke. And since the vision of how to do that was probably given by the god in the first place, you have a resonance there that is just unknown today. Okay, 29 years ago, I spent a night in the sarcophagus of the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid of Giza and felt as I lay there that I was being drawn into the vibratory field of that space, into some ancient presence. I spontaneously intoned a note, and the entire red granite sarcophagus rang like a bell, actually and truly rang, not just in my meditative imagination. So if you ever get to Egypt, you might give that a try. Well, let's see, how are we doing on time? Well, we got about 10 minutes. Great.
Francis, you have a couple of hands up, but you also have some follow-on comments from your question.
Okay.
Brent added that it's resonance, which I think you were talking about. Ayla, that it's living beings in relationship. Malia, that it's the science of harmonics, which is mathematical. And I would like to add my two cents worth in that, yes, that's exactly what we are dealing with in astrology, is
absolutely
the harmonics, the angles, the aspects and relationships. So, and
yes,
then,
indeed.
So those are the comments.
Let me comment there, hang on, that, you know, when you get, as I mentioned before, you take any one of these esoteric sciences and you take it to the archetypal level, and it's going to manifest as the living entity working through a specified form, and that form is geometrical in nature, you know, whether it's astrology or psychology or whatever. So thanks for the comment. Any others?
Yes, Martin has his hand up, so okay, go ahead, Martin.
Well, everybody has just said all together what I was thinking, which had to do with the word, the sound, the soundless sound, and then the word coming into manifestation are behind creation, and certainly the harmonics, the ratios, the resonance, it all have something to do with the word coming into manifestation through form in its geometric precision.
Yes, that's brilliant, actually. You know, wouldn't you love to be able to see the form of Om? You know, I mean, we could imagine that it is, for instance, a circle with a point in the center. In fact, Dwal Kool gives us a chart where he shows different levels of this word Aum, A-U-M, and Om, O-M, and he describes it as a, you know, a circle, finally, with this little tiny M in the center, and that's because the M represents the form side and the O, the archetypal informing source, right? So, but, you know, the form is always just the tracks of the animal, right? I mean, if you have, you know, for instance, a square or a cube or whatever, it's the tracks of the living source, and that's what we're after here in this study, you know, a way to experience these living sources. Any other comments?
Yes. Asha asked, what does coherence mean? Is it resonance of a group rather than an individual?
Well, coherence is, it can manifest on an individual level, because in a sense you're never out of the group realm, are you? You know, our bodies are an organized massive group of cells which are working in coherent concord, right? But when we can consciously align with a group purpose, then we become cells in a greater body. In fact, you know, it's described that we're all, as human beings, cells in the body of the Lord of the World, you know, Sanat Kumara, the logos of this planet. So I hope that answers your question. Yeah. Any others? Any other comments?
I don't see any hands at this point.
Okay. Okay. We're going to have to wrap this up. We got about 5 minutes left. My goal is to design these webinars in such a way that they will help us better understand these archetypal energies that we've been talking about for the last hour and a half by studying the forms through which they manifest as in a way of a reverse engineering. But if we get fixated on the forms, which is easy to do because they're so cool, right, and quit paying attention to the energy that these forms invoke, our study will become geometry rather than sacred geometry, number rather than sacred number, right? So, so something to keep in mind. Okay, if during today's webinar you've come up with ideas about what you'd like to see presented during this series, let me know. In fact, you know, we have a 3 minutes and 40 seconds, so if you have any thoughts about this, things you'd like to see presented during a future webinar, speak up now. And I won't say forever hold your peace, because you can offer it at any time. Any ideas about what you'd like to see presented in these webinars having to do with sacred geometry or number? Thoughts?
I'd like to say you got another comment from Asha. She says, thank you for this amazing, thought-provoking, brilliant presentation. I feel like a light has been shown, and my heart feels a stirring. Thank you.
So. Oh, well, my heart feels a stirring, too. Thank you. What a wonderful
group
compliment.
Cohesion.
That's terrific. Thank you. Okay. Any final questions or comments or thoughts? Okay. Oneness and this symbol will be the focus of our next webinar entitled What's the Point?, which will be the first in a series on the numbers 1 through 10, you know, kind of like something Sesame Street might produce. This webinar will take place appropriately on Father's Day, June 15th, appropriately because the number one and the father aspect have a lot in common. And I'm going to move the time back an hour from 9 p.m. GMT to 8 p.m. GMT because I got a lot of emails from Europeans, including Michael Robbins, who said, I'd like to come, but your webinar starts at 12 midnight, you know. So maybe it'll be a little easier next time. We can make some adjustments on this and make that possible. Now, I'm hoping this doesn't put a burden on any of our Australians who, you know, for which it's early morning. But I think it's the best way to go with this. Okay, well, we've got a minute left. This has been a real pleasure for me, and I want to thank you all for signing up for the series. And thanks, Brett and Biel. I really appreciate your work with this. And I'll see you all on June 15th.
You've got a couple of more comments coming
Terrific.
In here.
We have the time.
Marsh says, great job, thanks. Kay says, in future quotes, will you list the page number from the book, please?
Sure.
Martin says, thank you. Nancy says, could it be that purity of heart is the key to pure or direct knowing? That would cast a new light on the path, wouldn't it, in relationship to understanding spiritual geometry?
Absolutely.
Thank you for this exceptional experience.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Who made that?
That was Nancy. Do you want me to unmute her so she can?
That's okay. I'll just respond to you since we're out of time here. Well, yes. That the idea that the intelligence of the heart or the heart mind, which is pure reason, is other than mental conception, right? And so, yes, it is a direct knowing because the Buddhic plane is the plane of unity. So, yes. Okay, any others?
Allison says, thank you so much. Risa, enlightening our minds in Taurus. Good job. And appropriate. Vadna Sue says, thank you. So.
Oh, terrific. Thank you all.
I've caught the comments from everybody. So.
Okay. All right. Well, then, I'll see you on June 15th, an hour earlier at 8 p.m. GMT. And thanks again for signing up.